This is Wins and Losses with Clay Travis. Clay talks with the most entertaining people in sports, entertainment, and business. Now, here's Clay Travis.
Welcome into the Wins and Losses podcast. Hope you guys have been enjoying all the guests. We're about to be joined by former Titans and Rams coach Jeff Fisher. I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. But I want to encourage you to make sure you go back through all of the other interviews that we've done. I'm telling you, they're really entertaining. One a week, podcast only. You guys are listening to this one. If you haven't listened to some of the other ones, you will absolutely love it. Encourage you to rate the podcast as well. Appreciate all the feedback that we've gotten so far. So, I believe he is currently in Montana at his cabin. We bring in now Jeff Fisher, and I want to start with that question. I've never been to Montana before. I believe that's where you are. When did you first start going there? What is it about Montana that appeals to you, and what is the environment that you're in right now? How isolated are you? What's your situation?
A lot of questions at me right away, Clay. It's a great place, and yeah, I am. I'm up here, and last couple of years, I've tried to spend as much time as up here. I'm splitting my time between here and Nashville, the place you know very well. We're just kind of, outside of Yellowstone National Park on a lake up here. It can be as remote as you want it to be. You can walk 20 minutes up the hill and, be chased down by a grizzly bear if you're not careful. But at this time of the year, there's a lot of people here. But we do a lot of fishing. I got the place in 95, actually. And so we've been, over the years, if you take into consideration what I've been doing, you rush up here during bye weekend for 2 days, or you come up for 3 or 4 weeks with the kids during the summer before you go to camp. But beyond that, I hadn't seen it up until the last couple of years in the fall. It's a gorgeous place. A lot of things to do, a lot of fun stuff, do a lot of fishing, and it's not hard to get in and out of, but the weather's just awesome right now. I leave end of November. Things start to freeze up. The lake freezes, and animals decide to sleep for the winter, so it's time to head back to Nashville.
How many acres do you have?
I just have a few acres up here on the lake, but I'm kind of backed up to National Forest. So even though I don't actually own it, it's wide open country. It's really cool.
So you mentioned grizzly bears, and I'm fascinated by wildlife and everything else. What's the closest you've ever come to a grizzly bear?
Well, I say that facetiously. I've seen tracks. I've seen evidence, obviously evidence. But I'm here in the state of Montana. You see them from a distance sometimes when you're cruising around. I've never seen one on foot. And I hope not to. However, I was on a recent trip in Alaska and was probably 50 yards from the same species. They refer that to as a brown bear, but they're different up there. They're not that they're used to people, but they're not interested. They're busy fishing and doing their own business. They see you, they run off and things like that. They're much more aggressive up here. Unfortunately, there's been some incidents here in the last few years, and so you got to be mindful of it, especially in the fall.
All right, so I like to start with kind of working how you got to where you are now. And I know a lot of your history because I grew up in Nashville, but you grew up in Southern California. And I'm curious, when you were young, what was your lifestyle like? Did you play a lot of other sports? And when did you realize, hey, I'm a pretty good athlete? Like, was there a moment where a light bulb kind of came on and you realized you were good enough maybe to play in college, play at SC?
Clay, it's interesting. Yeah, I grew up in the West San Fernando Valley, went to Taft High School, and was like most of the guys you go to high school with, you play football, you play baseball. And if we weren't playing football or baseball, we were surfing, and because we were just over the hill. So most of the spare time in high school was surfing, and then there are even times when we surfed in the morning and skied in the afternoon. You can do that in Southern California.
That's wild.
Athletically, I love baseball, love football. I dedicated myself to it. I had a great deal of respect for the underclassmen that, you remember back in high school when the game was really pure. I don't think there's any substitute for high school football, but, you respected those guys that were older than you were. And I remember saying, hey, you're going to be pretty good. You keep working at this and quit not surfing as much. But so long story after that, I was, I got in a lot of inquiries and a lot of interest at the college level, and then all of a sudden things just stopped my senior year. And as it turns out, my baseball coach told the football recruiters that I didn't want to play football, I wanted to play baseball. So I got a late start in the recruiting game, and then right before the signing day, USC contacted me, and I ended up going to Southern Cal. So it all worked out. I had a couple of baseball scholarships, but I struggled. Once they started bending that ball a little bit, you know, it comes at you, and then curves and stuff like that, I had some hard time hitting it. But it was a great experience growing up there. I went to Southern California, and then, you know, I was drafted. I didn't expect to get drafted. I hoped that maybe I would be able to get into camp someplace. And then I got drafted by the Bears right prior to the 1981 season in Chicago.
All right, I want to go back to SC. If you don't get a football scholarship to SC, which direction does your life go?
I am attending the University of Santa Clara. That was really the only thing that I had. I was a red shirt, so I made the most of my time, Clay. I graduated on time. I went back, played my senior year as a graduate student, took two or three graduate courses, and took one more class just to stay eligible. By the way, it was a music class, and it was my only D in college. So,
how did you actually get a D in the music class? What happened?
I just couldn't play the little recorder they had, and I didn't take it very serious. I was playing ball in the fall, so I was more interested in trying to figure out a way to get back to the Rose Bowl than I was going to music class. But nonetheless, I got my degree, and had I not gone to SC, I probably would have gone to Santa Clara up in the Bay Area. I was, aggressively recruited up there, and I kind of fell in love with it. And that was the home of Dan Pastorini, as a matter of fact. But things worked out. You go through. I played with some good players, obviously, like Ronnie Lott and Dennis Smith and Joey Brown in the secondary, and Norv Turner was our DB coach, and I kid him a lot. He didn't have to do much coaching that year, but because I took it over for him. But it was a great experience, a great tradition. It was, obviously a great time attending the University of Southern California.
So you show up with the Bears in the early 80s there. You got Mike Ditka, you've got Jim McMahon, Walter Payton. You had already been in school in L.A., so I imagine you'd at least gotten used, and you mentioned all those great players that you were alongside, and also SC is the kind of place where you're around kind of that Hollywood lifestyle in some way. But having said all that, did it still seem overwhelming to suddenly find yourself on the Bears?
Well, it was pretty intimidating. At that time, Neil Armstrong was the head coach.
Oh.
The only person I knew of the Bears. I was an NFL fan coming out of college, but Vince Evans, a former Trojan, was there. You knew Walter Payton, and I knew the DBs. I knew that Gary Fensick and Doug Plank were heavy hitters, and I got drafted up there, and I was a little uncomfortable to say the least, but found a way to make the roster. My first year, Buddy Ryan was a defensive coordinator, and it was a great experience. And there's so many amazing stories about my time there. Neil was let go, Mike came in. We started improving and getting better and better, and then draft Jim, and then they put that roster together, and then the 85 season was was an amazing experience. I got hurt in training camp. I went on injury reserve. I healed up. I practiced every day, but was never activated, and ended up helping Buddy on the sideline and doing things. And then I ended up, after the 85 Super Bowl, I ended up joining Buddy in Philadelphia when he took the Eagle job.
So you're in that Super Bowl shuffle video, right?
And no, I couldn't dance. I wasn't asked, and it was pretty interesting to see the whole thing go down, because there was a lot of bitching and complaining and tugging back and forth, because people wanted more credit than other people, and they wanted this to go to their charity and this charity. But nonetheless, it was one of those rare instances in sports where somebody came out well prior to the Super Bowl and basically told the world, "Hey, we're going to the Super Bowl."
And, what was it? Yeah, no, I mean, that was an incredible, sorry to cut you off there.
Yeah.
But what was it like? What do you remember about Walter Payton? What do you remember about Jim McMahon, the Refrigerator Perry? I mean, that was an iconic team, and Mike Ditka, obviously, that still, I feel like, is an iconic team. Sometimes championship teams kind of vanish. This one hasn't.
It has not. As a matter of fact, it's funny you bring it up. Two summers ago, I got invited back to it wasn't a reunion. It was more of an autograph thing, and most of the players, 85 Bears, came back. And it was an unusual experience for me personally because I'll paint the visual for you. You know, everybody came out, and you signed for 30 minutes, and there was a schedule, and there were people waiting in long lines. And I came out, and I happened to sit next to Mike Ditka's line, his desk. He was sitting there signing. And I felt really uncomfortable because there were hundreds of people in my line and just a few in Mike's. And the reason for that was I was the last autograph that so many of those Bear fans were waiting on.
Oh, wow.
From the 85 Bears, because I had never come back for any of the events because I've been busy for obvious reasons. So it was really kind of cool to see everybody, to see Mike. You know, I stayed in touch with Mike and a lot of those guys. But, you know, I was sharing a Walter Payton story, you know, yesterday with a guy I was fishing with. And it's really interesting, you know, how he was. I mean, Walter and I had a different relationship, particularly because, you know, obviously we came from completely different backgrounds. So I'm the surfer boy from Southern California, and he's a gymnast from you know, Mississippi. But the one thing we had in common is we loved to duck hunt, and so we did a lot of that in my time there, just he and I. And so I got to know him, you know, a different side of him. For the listeners, can you imagine a 5'9½", 5'10", running back weighing about 205 pounds with size 8½ feet, jumping up on his hands on the goal line and walking on his hands across the field 100 yards. That's the kind of athlete that Walter was. And he was a prankster, and, you know, everybody talks about him. And I was just, you know, it was just a unique relationship with him, I think, like everybody did. And then, you know, fast forward a number of years, Walter unfortunately passes way too young. And we, in Nashville, Tennessee, brought Jared Payton in. Nobody wanted to sign him after draft. He had that 1 year when Willis McGahee got hurt down at University of Miami. Jared was a starter, and I think he had a good season. And so we brought him in, and then 2 years later, we brought Connie in, his mom, Walter's wife, and because I thought he was going to have a chance to play. We're playing the Texans. They had, you know, just getting started, that franchise. They weren't very good, expected to win. And Jared got a carry, and he had a touchdown, his only NFL touchdown for us in front of his mom in Houston. So, you know, I stayed close with that family. So it was a really cool experience. But those personalities, they're there. You know, so much attention, and not taking anything away, Clay, from the Eagles and what happened and what that did to Philadelphia. You know, so many people said, well, this will rival the 85 Bears. Well, what the Eagles did was an amazing task 2 years ago to win a championship. I don't think it'll ever rival the 85 Bears just because of the number of years and where those 85 Bears are now in Chicago sports history. You know, they're all legends, and they're all still around, and they all come back, and, you know, they all have great memories, and it was a great experience.
All right, so you go into coaching, and like you said, you move over to the Philadelphia Eagles. And by the way, I'm Clay Travis. This is the Wins and Losses podcast. We're talking with former Titans coach as well as former Rams head coach, Jeff Fisher. And so you work your way through. Did you, when you made the decision to become a defensive assistant and then to DB coach, did you think to yourself consciously, this is how I'm going to spend the rest of my professional career? Was it a decision like that, or was it something that just kind of happened on a gradual basis? I'll try this out. See what happens.
Well, I'm standing on the practice field the week prior to the Super Bowl in New Orleans, and I'm standing back with Buddy Ryan, who's calling the defensive signals at practice. And he says to me, he goes, you're not going to try to play again next year, are you? And I go, yeah, buddy, I'm healthy. He goes, are you getting married? I go, yeah, Julie and I are going to get married. He goes, you need to tell your fiance to throw you a retirement party because you can't play anymore. I want you to come coach with me. And I said, what do you mean, coach with you? He goes, don't tell anybody, but I'm going to take the Philadelphia Eagle job. So that's kind of how it went down. I knew 3 or 4 days prior to the 85, the Super Bowl win over New England. And And then I had a week to tell them. I'd started a business in Chicago. I was selling software and, you know, and didn't know whether I wanted to go back and play or not. I did make one commitment to myself back then prior to stepping on the field training camp, and that was, as a rookie, was, you know, at some point if my body got to the point where I was going to be denied opportunities to do things later in life, I'd leave it. And I'd, you know, broken leg and a couple surgeries and, you know, stuff like that. And I was feeling pretty good. So it was a tough decision, but I elected to leave on my own terms. I still had time left on a contract with the Bears to get into coaching, not knowing what coaching was going to be like. I had no idea what the rewards were. You know, player rewards are obvious. You go out, you win, you play good, but coaching rewards are different. And, you know, wins and losses for players, they're over in 8 to 10 hours after. They linger for coaches for days and weeks, sometimes years. But it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and I'll never forget the experience that I had. I was a month ago here. I was in town and grabbed a bite to eat. I was sitting there by myself, and on the television above the bar, there was the show. It was a special on Reggie White and Jerome Brown. And it was at ESPN. I forget what it's called, but it was impressive. And there I was. I appeared, and I was interviewed. I was the coordinator, and that I had a chance to coordinate that defense with those great players, that Philadelphia Eagle defense. And you know, I knew at that point, once Buddy gave me the opportunity to coordinate, that this is what I really wanted to do. And you know, to this day, I'm forever grateful to Buddy Ryan.
What was Reggie White like?
Reggie White was the biggest, most athletic, powerful human being I'd ever seen. I forget who the Dallas Cowboy right tackle was, but he literally retired during the season the week before we were to play. He was going to line up and try to block Reggie White. It was really something to watch. And then you've got, you know, rest his soul, Jerome Brown, and, you know, obviously Mike Golick and Mike Pitts and that whole group, Clyde Simmons and that whole group of defensive players. They were, you know, they were a sight to behold, man. It was there was some great, great defensive battles, and it was a dominating, painful defense to watch. But they were pretty good.
Some people listening to us right now know the name Buddy Ryan. They may not remember him. What was his coaching style like, and what was it like to be working with him?
Buddy was brutally honest. He liked two things. He liked tough players and smart players. He didn't care anything else. He said if you weren't tough and you weren't smart, you couldn't play for him. And those were his guys. He was extremely loyal to his guys, sometimes to a fault. And Buddy had a sign that carried with him, you know, in his office in Philly, and then he had it back in Chicago. And sign, it was the only thing that was hanging on the wall, and it said, "If you ain't the lead dog, the scenery never changes." And you know, that's the Oklahoma and Buddy. He was, you know, he was a fixture. I mean, he changed the game. I recently, several months ago, Clay, I got somebody tracked me down and sent me a text or an email and wanted to know if he could spend time with me because he wanted to try. He was trying to make some adjustments in that defense. The 46 defense. Now, there's hybrids and everybody's doing things and things like that, but this guy knew what he was talking about. He had studied it, and he somehow tracked me down. But Buddy was, you know, Buddy was cutting edge. He was way ahead of his time from a game planning standpoint, from a matchup standpoint, creating matchups. You know, Buddy was, you know, it doesn't sound that far out there, but Buddy knew that if he put Reggie White on the center, and the center had one hand between his legs on the ball, that there was no way that center was going to block Reggie White. And what happened was the guard had to help him. And as soon as the guard helped the center, then there's an unblocked rusher in the pocket knocking the quarterback down. And that's, you know, that's how Buddy, he stumbled on a lot of things. And he was an amazing man to work for. And, you know, Rex and Rob were twins, and they were growing up, and they hung around camp. And they, you know, they've come out to camp, and they started their coaching careers. And I'm really happy to see them be very successful in the National Football League.
You continue to coach. You work your way defensive coordinator with Buddy Ryan. You end up the head coach of the Houston Oilers as an interim. Then you get that job. You were incredibly, I think, young at the time to get that job. Were you ready for it, and what was it like to suddenly have all the responsibility on yourself?
I took over the defense in an unusual set of circumstances. They were working for Coach Pardee. It was my first year there. Buddy had come to Houston for 1 year, and he got that group together. That was a year prior to the salary cap, and he got that group together in 1 year. Unfortunately, they lost to Kansas City and Joe Montana in the playoffs, and then Buddy got the Arizona job, so Houston didn't want to change the system, so I left the 49ers. I was a secondary coach there, and I came in and coordinated. So, but that was the year that the team was divided. You remember the Kevin Gilbride, Buddy Ryan stuff, and the punches thrown on the sideline. And the team was really divided, offense and defense. It was a run-and-shoot offense. Wasn't equipped really to do the conventional things in the National Football League. And so, you know, with four games left, they let go the offensive coordinator and the head coach, Kevin Gilbride, Jack Pardee, and I took over as interim. So I had 4 weeks of experience, and I could write a book just on those 4 weeks of things that took place. But, you know, we sat around. Floyd Reese was that was his first year as general manager there, and Mike Hollaback had retired. And you know, Floyd, he took his time, as I did, and we spent time together every day for about 2 weeks, and then finally he decided to hire me, which I'm forever grateful for. And so we, you know, before you know it, now we're moving.
And, yeah, well, so, how did you get that news, and what did you know about Nashville, if anything?
Well, this will hit home for you. We came back during camp. We came to Marysville College outside of Knoxville to practice against the Washington Redskins. North Turner was the head coach. He Shuler's the rookie. He's the number one pick.
Oh, yeah.
And so we came in there for a week to work against the Redskins and play a preseason game at Leland Stadium. And during that week of practice, I was informed that there may be an announcement this afternoon or tonight that we're looking at the possibility of moving the franchise to Nashville. And I never forget saying, well, what do you mean, maybe? Well, they're going to announce. I go, well, I've got to tell the team. He goes, no, you don't have to. No, I have to tell the team. And so I told this team, and I'll never forget the looks on their face when I told them that. It was like we just lost an overtime playoff game. It just rocked their world. And here you are in the preseason. And so we go back to Houston. All things are just flying crazy all over. And then the next week we have a preseason game canceled. And then there's lawsuits and referendums and stadium issues. And it was just a mess. 95, my first year. 96, we stayed there. And then we moved in 97. So we found out in June of 97, after being lame duck in Houston for 2 years, that we were leaving. This is June, mind you. And you remember the kicker, Al Del Greco?
Oh, yeah.
Al had deposits in schools for his kids in Houston, in Nashville, and in Birmingham, because he didn't know where he was going to live. And so we packed up and moved in a month. No place to move to. I hadn't built a temporary facility, and we had training camp at TSU. So that started the whole deal in 97. Then, of course, you know, we played in Memphis 97. And
which was a disaster, right? For people who don't know the rivalry between Nashville and Memphis, you guys were based in Nashville. And then what would you do, get on planes and fly down to Memphis, or did you bust down?
We did. We flew. That was our home games, and that was the same question the players asked, Clay, because they go, so, Coach, let me get this straight. So we're moving to Nashville, but we're playing in Memphis? Yeah, that's right. So how far is Memphis from Nashville? Well, it's, you know, I didn't want to say 200 miles, roughly,
yeah.
But so we're going to fly? Yeah, we're going to fly. We're going to be able to go back home to Nashville with our families after the game? No. You're going to have to fly back. Really? So, yeah, so I would fly back home, and I'd have dinner ready for Julie and the kids before they drove back from the games.
Oh, yeah,
so
that's
essence,
crazy.
It was a 16-game road season. So, and then we got closer. That didn't work out, and they moved into Vanderbilt. And then 99, obviously, the rest is history.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We're talking to Jeff Fisher. I'm Clay Travis. This is the Wins and Losses podcast. Then you move into Vanderbilt. Then you move into LP Field. So, I don't remember what it was. Adelphia Coliseum. You're right.
Yes, sir.
So let's go back for a second to the drafting of Steve McNair.
Okay.
Because for a lot of people out there, that's really when they became aware of both you and the Tennessee Titans, right? Eddie George, Steve McNair.
Right.
When did you and how did the Houston Oilers come to draft Steve McNair? What do you remember about him as you went through that draft process?
That's a great, great question. And we had gone down, Floyd and I, and then our director, one of our player personnel directors and our offensive coordinator at the time, Jerry Rome. We went down to Alcorn for Steve's pro day, and we spent time with Steve and his mom, Lucille. She had a big barbecue out there after the pro day, and Steve threw the ball around, and we got him on the board and just absolutely loved him. And there was no doubt that he was our guy. Just loved everything about Steve and his family and, you know, his agent, Bus Cook. And it was just a match made. And so fast forward, Friday night before the draft, this is expansion draft. So this is Carolina Jacksonville's first go-round. The league's just expanded from 30 to 32 teams. So Carolina's up, Jacksonville's two, and we were three. So Friday night, Carolina trades with they trade out to Cincinnati. Cincinnati goes to one Friday night, and then on Saturday, Cincinnati drafts Kajana Carter.
Now, were you guys afraid that they might take a quarterback at that time, or what did you anticipate?
Here's what happens. So now Jacksonville's on the clock, and all we hear about is Tony Boselli. That's what they want. They had this expansion thing and the draft, and they got Mark Brunell. And so, you know, we're pretty sure that they want Tony Boselli, tackle from USC. So we get a call. They're on the clock. Floyd gets a call from Tom Coughlin. And Coach Coughlin says, hey, I got somebody that wants to move up to get your quarterback. I'll take a fourth from you and switch spots so you can get your quarterback and we'll get our guy. And Floyd turned the worst color and just hung up and thought the world was going to end. And because Mr. Adams' plane is there in New York to pick up Steve, and we cannot not draft Steve. And so anyway, this bluff process took place for about 10 minutes. I think there was 20 minutes between.
What does that feel like, by the way, when you're getting bluffed like that? Like, how
well,
like sitting at the poker
saying,
table, right?
You know what, Clay? Floyd just, he saw a big picture. I was just focused on, there's no way he's bluffing you.
Yeah.
When somebody knows who you want, especially if they're ahead of you, they're going to get, you're going to pay for it because they're going to bluff you in the pick to switch spot. So anyway, it finally, after calls back and forth, you know, I'll give you a sixth. No. Okay. I'll give you a fifth. No. And I finally just said, Floyd, just believe me, trust, they're going to take Boselli. And then Floyd looked at me. Never wanted him to look at me again like he did. And he's like, if this is not right, you're freaking dead. And and we said no. And then you could hear Commissioner Tagliabue say, well, the second pick in the 1995 draft, the Jacksonville Jets. And we went, oh, my gosh. And then they took Tony Boselli. So we got Steve. So, yeah, it was, you know, it was a great time. It was a great time for the organization. And then, of course, we took our time. You know, we had Chris Chandler and Steve played sparingly here and there for a couple years, off and on, when we were ahead or when we were behind or when we were eliminated, and he got the opportunity. And then year three, became a full-time starter. So that's 95, 6, 7, year three, when we moved there, he's a full-time starter. 98 rolls around, and people are asking, well, great Steve, tell us what kind of quarterback he is. Is he a top 10 quarterback or a top 5 quarterback? And I said, you know, I don't know if he's a top 5 or top 10 quarterback, but I know if he's a top 3 football player. And that was 98, and 99 went to Super Bowl.
All right, so you also, it's and for people who may not remember this transition period, you guys had to basically create a new fan base in the city of Nashville. Tennessee, obviously, college football was already wild, but the NFL, people tended to root for the guys who played for their favorite college teams, right? Especially the big SEC fan base. For people who are listening to us and may not be familiar with the sporting landscape, you get Steve McNair, you get Eddie George, you get Frank Wycheck, you get Blaine Bishop, a lot of guys who become Al Del Greco, who you mentioned, sort of iconic linchpins of the community. Later on, you would do this again and move to another market with the Rams, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But how important and how much work did you guys spend on things that had nothing to do with football and everything with building the brand of the Titans and the NFL in the market?
Well, for 2 years, prior to the the first year there, even though we're in Memphis, and for 2 years during off season, we were doing nothing but caravans with the voice of the Titans, Mike Keith,
who's still there.
So we're caravanning all over the state, Crossville, Knoxville, Cooksville, and just meeting people and shaking hands and kissing babies. And we did that for several years. But deep down inside, we knew that winning was going to take care of everything. And we have to do this. In addition to that, you're going to have to go in the community. And it didn't take us long to realize how important the community was to Nashville, because when you drive down the street in Franklin and Vince Gill is playing, doing a benefit concert at Franklin High School because his daughter's going there.
Yeah.
You know that people give back here. And so that was what we're all about. And I think we set that tone with respect to the players, the ones you mentioned, that became those popular people in Nashville, the iconic people, the Kevin Dysons, and all those guys are still there.
Yeah.
And they realized that, and they, to this day, are still giving back. So, it was a great experience. But then, so now we open in that stadium.
Yeah.
Against Cincinnati on a hot September Sunday afternoon. I mean, it is really hot. And there's 9 minutes left to go in the game. There's five left, and we're down by nine. And we come back. Steve puts two drives together, and we put 10 points on the board. And my memory doesn't serve me right, but I think it was like a 35-34 game, and we beat them. And we don't beat Cincinnati because we could not stop Jeff Blake. We don't beat him if he doesn't cramp up and go out of the game and not return because it was so hot. So we win that game, and we won the first one, and we were undefeated at home that year.
So
what better scenario could you have when you open a new stadium and you go undefeated at home and you end up with those amazing playoff experiences? One, the Music City Miracle. Two, go to Jacksonville or go to Indy and beat Indy. And then three, go to Jacksonville, having beat them twice, and then have to beat them a third time, and they only had two losses that year, and we beat Jacksonville for a third time, the championship game, and came back, and then had a week turnaround, had to go to Atlanta.
All right, so my dad's a season ticket holder. When I'm a kid growing up at this point, I go to all those games. I want to go to the Music City Miracle game because it has become one of the most iconic plays in all of NFL history. I believe you designed the play, the home run throwback featuring Lorenzo Neal, Frank Wycheck, and Kevin Dysons. How did that play come about? And for people out there who don't really know the scene, this is a home playoff game. The team has just opened this brand new stadium. It's a hard fought game. They bring in Rob Johnson, I think, and start him over Doug Flutie. It's the Bills. And it looks like all is lost. They bomb through a long field goal. There's 23 seconds left or something like that. And you're thinking what on the sidelines?
I'm going to go back because for years, we had worked practice every Saturday, the Stanford Cal play.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Oh,
everybody
yeah.
knows the Stanford Cal. Well, we had a Stanford Cal team. It was athletic guys, not big guys, but left-handed, right-handed guys that could just throw the ball around and keep it alive. And so we worked it for years. Well, prior to the 99 season, Coach Lowry, our special teams coach, came to me and he goes, "Hey, I was just doing some stuff over the summer and I found this play. I want you to take a look at it." And so it was back in the 60s. It was a Texas A&M or somebody. And he showed this play and there was method to the madness. And I said, "I love it. Let's put it in." So we worked that play every Saturday prior to a Sunday game throughout the 99 season. Now we get into this situation. Here we are. Just like you say, 23 seconds left. They kick the field goal. We're down. And TV timeout, and Allen walks up, and we simultaneously say home run throwback is what we named it. And so I'm Derek Mason is our primary deep guy, and Derek is out. He has a concussion. His backup is Anthony Dorsett Jr., who worked it in practice, and he's out because he's cramping. He cramped every week, seemed like. But so now I go to Kevin Dyson on the sideline, and I say, Kevin, hey, you remember home run throwback? We practice it every Saturday. Kevin goes, Coach, I never really paid attention. So I say, okay, here's the deal. Really,
and this is while the crowd is going crazy, yeah. Right? Like, this is literally...
The crowd is starting to leave because we're behind, and there's 23 seconds left.
Yeah.
And so it's like, Kevin, I don't care what happens, where the ball goes, I want you to stay 5 yards behind the ball right here on these numbers. See, the 10, 20, 30? He goes, yeah, Coach, I gotcha. So 5 yards obviously translates into, you know, five inches. But nonetheless, we have worked, Clay, we worked every kick during the year except for that bloop kick. We would punch balls to every single player on that team, and their job was to get it to Frank. And then we start to play. And now I see that ball go up in the air, and I went, oh, my gosh.
They popped it short.
To do with it? Well, Lowe didn't want to have anything to do with it. He just caught it and gave it to Frank. And when he gave it to Frank, I see Kevin kind of out of the corner of my eye standing back. And then when Frank gets the ball back, I see the far official, Byron Boston was his name, outstanding NFL official. I see him push his point backwards, which means he's ruled a lateral on the field. And then Kevin starts up the sideline, and here he goes. And I'm kind of watching this thing, and I go, because we're down by a field goal ties. And so I'm kind of saying, Kevin, get out of bounds. And I look down the further side, I go, oh, man, score. And he scores. So now the place is going nuts. And I knew that there's really no way they could overturn this on the field because I was familiar with replay, and I knew it was ruled a lateral on the field. And so I'm a step further. Okay, now if they do not overturn this and this stays and the ruling on the field stands, we're up by five, and I got to go for two. But I thought to myself two things: one, once this announcement comes, there's no way we'll be able to run an offensive play, and two, what are the odds of this happening twice in the same game? And I don't know if you remember, but my heart was in my throat because on that kickoff, they got that ball out to midfield and the game ended.
Yeah.
And, so it was an amazing experience in that locker room. And, it was that set us going. You know, that set us on fire for the next week.
So I was in the north end zone there where Ben Dyson scored.
So are you one of those 100,000 people that weren't there?
No.
You were there?
I will swear to the God. I stayed and I was with my dad who had the tickets. You know, I was a college kid at the time. Yeah, there are a lot of people who say that they were there. And I can remember there were a lot of people streaming out, and there were a lot of people who came running back when they heard the stadium erupt over what had happened. And so that's really, I think, where you guys sort of become on the national stage, right? Up until that point, you had a good year, I think 13-3 or something that in the regular season. But people are like, oh, is this going to work in Nashville? What in the world's going on? You played in Memphis. You played at Vanderbilt. New stadium, new coach, relatively speaking, new quarterback. And then you go on the road, I think, and beat Indy. And then you say probably the most outspoken thing you've ever said as a coach before, which is not only do you have the home field at Adelphia, you also say that I believe Jacksonville is one of your home fields, too.
Well, this was after the Jacksonville win at Jacksonville.
Okay.
And
yes.
The story behind that was, so, you know, Jacksonville's 14-2.
And they have home field that year.
Home field, they beat Miami in the first playoff game 60-0 or something like that.
Yeah.
And so now we're coming down to Jacksonville. Now, they've lost two games, and they've been both to us.
Yes.
And so what are the chances of them losing to us the third time? Well, what happens is that because this was the last Super Bowl played with 1 week between a championship game and the Super Bowl, we had to send our advanced people down immediately to Atlanta because we're playing, if we, this is before the game now, okay, we got our advanced people in Atlanta looking at the venues and all this stuff, preparing in case we win. If we win, we're going. If we don't, Jacksonville goes. Well, I heard before the game that before the game itself in Jacksonville, that the rent-a-car fleet already had Jaguar decals on it before the game.
Wow.
And so we win. The game's over. Hey, we're going to Super Bowl. We're just consumed with having to turn around and go down to bad weather and send the team down there for media day and keep the coaches behind the game plan and get everybody there. So on Friday, 2 days before the Super Bowl and the final press conference, Coach Vermeil and I are there, and we're taking your pictures with the Super Bowl trophy and all that stuff and asking the final questions. And the last question, guy in the back raises hands and he goes, "Yeah, Steve, I got one more question." And I said, "My name's Jeff." And then he says, "What's it like to play in four different venues in 4 years?" And I said, "Well, it's actually five if you would include Alltel Stadium in Jacksonville."
That's such a great line.
And that's because of all the stuff that went on and Jacksonville had every right to expect to be there, but they kind of pushed us out of the way and said, "Hey, Coach Coughlin, they want it this way, so we don't care what you guys want if you come." And it was just that kind of whole thing. So, yeah. So, needless to say, I'm still quite popular in Jacksonville.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
I'm Clay Travis. This is the Wins and Losses podcast. We're talking with former Titans and Rams head coach Jeff Fisher. So I didn't remember that there was only 1 week to get ready. What's it like to win the AFC Championship game? I know you guys came back to Nashville and had an incredible rally, but the adrenaline can't really slow down at all the way through into that Super Bowl against the Rams, right? I mean, that's crazy to think about now that there was no – now you get that bye week to kind of get your breath, kind of get everything fixed. That's wild that you guys had to turn around and play that quickly.
Well, it's currently that first week is football, and that's game planning, and that's where everybody does their stuff.
Yeah.
Because second week is travel and media day and all the other stuff. So we didn't have that. We had to do it all. So, as I said, I left the coaches behind, went with the players the next day. We had a meeting until midnight after we got back from Jacksonville. And, guys, here's the deal. You get these tickets to your family. Here's where we're staying. You got to be here packed, and we're flying to Atlanta. And then the weather was bad, so, nonetheless, we got it together and got the plan together. Now, it did help that we had played the Rams, early in the year, and we beat them at home, and so we had familiarity, and I trusted the staff. It was a veteran staff, and we got a good plan together. But still, having to go to the Super Bowl and go out and practice outside on ice and AstroTurf, and have to just ask them if they could maybe bring some heaters into the media tent because it's really cold. I mean, it was a blur. It was really just a blur. And then obviously it was a great game. It's an outstanding game.
How many times? So when you play in a Super Bowl like that, or you coach in a Super Bowl, how many times have you gone back and actually watched that game? It's been 20 years now, one of the most iconic Super Bowls of all time between you and the Rams. How many times have you gone back and watched or gone over the decisions that you made in that game?
Once, because I did a project for somebody, a network or somebody, some special. It was about 5 years ago. I got the coaching tape and sat there and looked at the coaching tape. So I knew what happened. I knew every play. I remember, recall every decision and all that, and the injuries and all those things. And so it was only once. So.
Is there anything that you would change? Like, so when you go, and the podcast is called Wins and Losses because my contention is that you learn as much or more from losing as you do from winning, right?
More so.
And I bet you would agree with that as a coach. When you go back, if there were two calls or one call you could have differently in that game, you go back and you change what?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the particular call. It was the philosophy, I think, that it was our first half philosophy on offense. I think we got caught up in this aerial circus of the Rams.
Yeah.
And we were doing something the first half that didn't get us there. And we were throwing the ball around and doing all this stuff. And so we had that long halftime and had time to sit down and rethink about it. And that was the deal is, you know what, we're in this and they feel like it's over and we're going to stay in this and get back and win this by doing what got us here, and that's pounding the football and playing good defense. Now, the defense thing was hard. Marcus Robertson broke his leg in the championship game the week before, starting free safety in Jacksonville. Blaine Bishop was knocked out of the game. And so we were finishing the Super Bowl against the, you know, the greatest show on turf with backup players at safety position. So we were dealing with injuries, and we had a couple mishaps and gave up some big plays. But, you know, I don't know if there's anything, you know, I've been asked so many times, had you scored, what would you have gone for two?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've said no, and because I would not want to rob all those players of a chance to win the Super Bowl, particularly because I felt the momentum had shifted. I felt the Rams were tired. Remember those clips of Kevin Carter standing on the sideline and Coach Vermeil going, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
I mean, they were tired, and I thought things would have changed. But, you know, the last play, I mean, do you change the last play? No, I just kind of, I think we all wish maybe Kevin would have pushed up another yard or two, because then and then come underneath Frank, and then Mike wouldn't have made that tackle short of the goal line. He probably would have walked in. But that's the great part of the game. And then you know, just the motions. And I think what's interesting to point out here, what was lost was, in all that, was what happened a couple days after that. And so the game's over. We regroup. We get back to Nashville. We have that great parade there, and the fans were just amazing. And the parade's over. I think it's Tuesday afternoon, and the Pro Bowl is that following. It's this coming Sunday. And Eddie walks in. Eddie George walks into my office, and he sits down, and he just got this look. He goes, Jeff, I don't want to go to Hawaii. I go, why? What are you talking about, Eddie? You're crazy? What are you talking about? He goes, no, I don't want to go. I go, Eddie, you're voted by your peers and the fans, and you're going to Hawaii. You got to go. What? Talk to me. What's going on? What's going through your mind? He goes, I want to go there because I want to start on next year right now.
Oh, that's such a great thought. Yeah.
And that was typical of that team. And So, you know, that's what we did. I mean, we did. And I think to a certain extent, you know, I may have failed Steve in that offseason because he hit a wall in the following year in 2000, came out of it, actually was going to retire. He was done. He's going to quit after an early game against Kansas City and a hard hit and a sternum injury. But you know, we found ourselves and we regrouped. And that next team, if you remember, in 2000, I thought was better than the 99 team. And we had a week off, and then we couldn't find a way to beat Baltimore in the first round of the playoffs.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a sec. Yeah. We're talking to Jeff Fisher, but I want to go back to the end of the Super Bowl. There are relatively few people ever in sports or in life who will have something so close to ultimate victory and be so enmeshed in it and be so all in on it and have it come to an end so quickly. It's like a basket getting drained in the NCAA tournament when you think you have a chance at the championship, right?
Yeah.
What does that moment feel like to you on the sideline when Kevin Dyson is tackled and he's reaching out to the goal line and it's so close? Your immediate feeling is what? Your immediate mindset is what?
Well, you know, you did a great job teeing this up. It was a numbing feeling, and it's hard to explain the feeling you have as it relates to being so close one moment before, and then the reality is that it's you didn't get it done. And I remember walking. I never found Coach Vermeil, but I found Steve, and he was on a knee. And
yes.
So I knelt down next to him, and then Lynn Swann came up, and he was covering the sideline. And he wanted to know what our conversation was, which tell him. And I said that was between Steve and I. And then we got back in the locker room, and it was just really, really just hard. It was different. And, you know, I remember standing up doing the post-game press conference outside the locker room, and just the cameras and the people, and I squinting through the bright lights of the cameras, and I could see my kids way in the back against the wall, and my kids were crying. They're young, but, you know, it's just like, wow. And then, of course, over a period of like 10 minutes or 15 minutes or so, I got two phone calls, one from President Clinton and one from Vice President Al Gore. Both, I mean, talking with so much energy and enthusiasm and excitement about what a great game. And I remember reminding them that, well, we lost. But no, you know, but so, you know, those things, I mean, those memories, you know, they last a lifetime. But, yeah, it's not an easy thing. It's something that takes time. I mean, you say it takes time. You ask me how many times I watched a game. Yeah, I watched it once because I had to. So, but it's, you know, it was a great experience. I mean, it's sometimes you know, life's not easy. And there, as you say, to, you know, you're going to learn more from a loss. Any coach, any person can stand in front of an NFL team on Monday after a win. That's easy. It's how you handle that, and how you handle the loss, and how you keep it in perspective, and how you get it behind you, and how you learn from it so it doesn't happen again. You know, some players only dread coming to work. I want them to look forward to coming to work. It's the only chance to overcome difficult times. But, yeah, it was an amazing experience. It was all short, too, you know. I don't know why the league just all of a sudden decided to have 2 weeks between it when we just had one. But, you know, shoot, I'll do it all over again.
What did you tell – you said that's between a player and a coach. And I want to get to Steve McNair and your continuing relationship with him and where you were when his untimely death happened and what that experience was like for you. But you said that's between a player and a coach. The player is no longer around. What did you tell Steve McNair?
Yep. Clay, I'm going to tell you, I've never told anybody this. I'll tell you. I appreciate the opportunity. You know, we kind of remember kind of, I put my arm on his pad and he put his arm around me and I go, hey man, I said, I love you. I said, you're the reason we're here right now. And he said, no, you are. And, he says, we're coming back. And I said, you bet we are. And, that was pretty much it, you know, but it was an amazing moment, you know, amazing moment. And, you know, he was so competitive and so tough and, you know, just so misunderstood, I think, by the average fan, that his depth and his fire, his competitiveness and his will. And, you know, it just was all there. I mean, it was just right there in his breath, you know, after that play.
You and he had, it seems, coaches and quarterbacks are really the linchpin to success, it seems to me, in the NFL, that relationship. And it seems to me that you and he had a special relationship. You mentioned the next year you guys come back and I think are a better team. And you're at home and you lose to the Baltimore Ravens, fluky game, right? You go through everything, blocked field goal, return for a touchdown, busted coverage in the secondary that leads to a big play. I don't know what the data was, but I mean, like, the Ravens put up almost no offensive yards on you, right? I mean, it was as if you just
looked at... They didn't get a first down in the second half.
Yeah, they didn't get... Okay, that's the way to bring it up. I'm in that crowd again. I watch that. It's incredibly frustrating, I'm sure. Does that game almost hurt you more than the Super Bowl game? Because I'm just curious, when you think about those teams, everybody thinks about the Super Bowl and how close you were, but you guys were the best team in the NFL that year.
Yeah, I mean, not to take anything away from the Ravens, but that Super Bowl was the Ravens and the Giants.
And they destroyed the Giants.
Yeah, we played with the Giants early in the year. But I wouldn't say it didn't hurt as much as a Super Bowl. You know, when you block two punts and they both go sideways out of bounds.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Eddie catches a check down. And the ball bounces off his shoulder and Ray Lewis and Ray's hands and Ray returns it for a touchdown. You know, it was their time. It wasn't ours. And that's, you know, that's a hard thing to explain in sports. You know, I could go back and, you know, I could go into each play and each turnover and each drop or what, or their big plays and our big, or the what ifs, but it just wasn't our time. And, you know, that was obviously frustrating because that was a, we were a better team. And, you know, I don't know what I'd do differently in that game. I thought we handled our week off and kept things, you know, kept our composure, you know, and, you know, there was a, these two teams didn't like each other.
Billick took shots at you, right? Like leading into that game, talked about,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, they wore camo and all that stuff during the week, and you know, and Ray was talking, and you know, and all that, and you know, and there was a lot of uncertainty regarding Ray because we all remember what happened, what Ray went through the year prior during the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's wild,
and that was. You know, we didn't know the truth. You didn't know the answers. You didn't know anything. And so, but here we are, you know, you know, they were in our division 2 years prior or whatever. And so, you know, it just was, it was just different. But, you know, it just, you know, it was really unfortunate. I mean, prior to that, I mean, it was a hard year because, to keep a team focused, a good team like our, the team we had in week 12 and week 13, because they're just thinking about getting back to the playoffs, knowing that, you know, it's we got to win these games to make sure that we can have a week off and rest. And, you know, I was proud of the guys, the way they handled themselves, and, you know, they kept things in perspective. And it just didn't happen. I mean, you know, I think George caught most passes that were thrown to him. This one bounced off his shoulder, and you know, it just happened. So, but anyway, yeah, Steve and I were, we're close. But Steve's moment came earlier in that year against Kansas City when, and I've discussed this, I've talked about this publicly, and especially at both times when I memorialized him. But he had had enough, and it was he was done. He got hit against the Chiefs and starting the fourth quarter. And he'd thrown a couple of interceptions, which weren't his fault. And here we are. I mean, it's early in the year. We've come up. We lost the Super Bowl. I mean, we represented the AFC. And Steve's going up the tunnel on a cart. You can't breathe. And in all kinds of pain. And the PA announcer announces, and now at quarterback, number 14, Neil O'Donnell. And the crowd went nuts. And, you know, Neil puts a couple balls in the end zone. We beat Kansas City. And then I go see Steve at the hospital. He's done. And we had a bye that next week, and then the following week we went to Pittsburgh. And I honestly, at that time, for a good week, didn't know whether he was ever going to come back. And you talk about having your work cut out for you. I did, and I spent a lot of time with him. And then as fate would have it, he's in his mind, Clay. He's done. But I convinced him to be number two going to Pittsburgh after the bye weekend, and Neil got knocked out of the game with inside of 2 minutes, and we were down by four or five, and I looked at Steve, and he looked at me, he winked, threw about three or four balls on the sideline, and put a four-play drive together to a touchdown pass to Aaron Kenney in the end zone, and we beat Steelers at Pittsburgh, and I was walking off with Steve, and it was amazing, just amazing. I knew he was right, you know, I knew he got it right, and the moral of that story, the lesson to be learned from it, and this is just my opinion that I learned through Steve and through observation over years. The quarterback position in the National Football League is really, really hard to play year in, year out, week in, week out. That's why I have so much respect for the guys that have done it at such a high level for so long, Drew Brees and Tom Brady and the rest. Because the pressure's not Sunday pressure. The pressure is Wednesday, Thursday, Friday practice pressure. Because if your quarterback throws interception in practice on Wednesday, you had a bad practice. If you have a bad practice, you're not going to win the game. And so it's just day after day after day. And so many, I won't mention any, but I know a handful of quarterbacks that in year four or five had that defining moment and they were done and wanted to leave and they just didn't want to do it anymore. Matter of fact, I've spoken to some coaches regarding their quarterbacks over the years, just observing. And, you know, you have to make this thing fun for them. Because it is a game. And if you're too serious on the practice field week after week after week on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, it's going to take its toll on a quarterback in his fourth or fifth year. Just my opinion, based on experience. And it did, but Steve overcame it, and he bounced back, and you know, Steve was an MVP 2 years later.
Yeah, and you had to flip your entire offensive system because it went from Eddie George as the dominant player on that offense and Frank Wycheck on the underneath throws to suddenly Steve McNair is a world beater, right? I mean, the watching him play those year, that year that he won the MVP was extraordinary.
It was an amazing year under Mike Heimerdinger and Steve and D. Mace and Drew Bennett and the group and Frank still and, you know, a variety of running backs and the and just and the defense. You know, we just were, you know, I mean, to be a co-MVP with Peyton Manning, that speaks volumes of Steve's production.
And you almost beat Belichick in New England in the divisional round game, I think, if I'm not mistaken. It came down to Drew Bennett having a chance to make a play on a ball that he probably got interfered on. And they didn't throw the flag, and you guys lose an insanely tight one.
That would have put us on another championship game. So, Drew had the ball. It was cold. We get it. It was a breadbasket catch, and we had a grounding call against us that gave us a bad field position we had to overcome, but it was a bad call. But, yeah, we were close again that year, the next year.
And then you went to the AFC Championship game against the Raiders. I mean, there were a lot of really great runs there. And then ultimately, you're in Nashville for a long time. The McNair era ends, and I've never asked this. I've never heard like a really detailed explanation of it. You guys have an intriguing decision. There are three quarterbacks that people believe are first-round quarterbacks. Jay Cutler, who is playing at Vanderbilt that year, so he's a Nashville guy. Vince Young and Matt Leiner coming out of USC, having won the Heisman Trophy. Reggie Bush is going to go, I believe, number one overall that year, if I'm not mistaken.
Actually, Houston took greeted terms with Mario Williams.
Okay, I'm sorry. And then does Reggie go two to the Saints? Was that it?
Yeah, he went to Saints, yeah.
And then you guys had the number three pick, right?
Correct.
How much debate was there about who to take? What was your decision? How much was Bud Adams involved? How much did you guys go around the horn kind of debating who to take at quarterback?
Well, you know, I'll say this. You know, we had Jay in the Senior Bowl.
Yep.
We knew Matt Leinart inside and out because Norm Chow was my offensive coordinator at that time. And
yes.
He had coached Matt. And then, you know, Vince won the national championship against SC for Texas. So we had options. And, you know, sometimes in life, you know, there's outside influences that make you go different directions. And, you know, I have to say that, I mean, I had great respect for Vince, thought he was going to be a great pro, and same with Matt and Jay. But we collectively, as an organization, Clay, decided that Vince was our guy.
And do you have, as the coach, I'm just curious, when that decision is being made, you've been with the Titans for a long time. If you disagree, like, how does the process get made? Do you all vote? I'm just kind of, and I'm sure every team is different and every organization is different. Or is it something where if the owner wants something, it doesn't matter what anybody else says?
That's correct.
So do you try and lobby Bud Adams and say, hey, maybe we should consider other things? Or what was he like? Was he the kind of guy who, when he makes his mind up, you can't wait?
Bud was just a great owner. And I say that because Bud just wanted to win. He loved the game. And, you know, Bud, if you had to know Bud. I mean, Bud, you could turn, and people say this all the time. I mean, you could have a purchase order on his desk for laser pointers for $200, and he wouldn't sign it for months. But if you needed $10 million to sign a free agent corner, he'd tell you to go ahead and do it.
That's amazing.
that's how he was. And, you know, I'm forever grateful to the Adams family because Bud gave him my chance. And, you know, the memories I have with Bud, and my job was to win games. And then when Houston came in the division, I only had to win two games a year.
Because he lived still in Houston, for people who don't know. And, like, that was a big deal for him. He would fly into games in Nashville, but he wanted to be able to walk around in Houston with his chest puffed out, having beaten the team that he used to have in that city.
Yeah, we had two Super Bowls every year. Yeah, and that was against Houston. But Bud was great. And, you know, so we go through this process. And, you know, it was a difficult thing with as it related to Steve, because Steve contract was where it was. And then, you know, there have been some injuries. And it might be time to bring in maybe his heir apparent. But then, you know, Steve got into a little issue there with Mr. Adams. He had a significant contract, and the injury thing was, if Steve got hurt in an off-season program, then Bud would owe a lot of money. So Bud, in essence, asked Steve not to come to work.
And that puts you in an awkward spot with your relationship with McNair.
No, it didn't. It really, because Steve knew it was not me.
Yeah,
and it, Steve, throughout our time together between Steve and I, did we have any awkward issues other than, you know, Steve wasn't perfect. You know, he'd miss a meeting or he'd do something, and, you know, you had to discipline him here and there. But, you know, and he knew it, and he knew it was coming, and he explained to him it's coming. But we never had any of those issues where we didn't see eye to eye. I remember being over at the hospital and in the recovery room waiting on one of my boys to have a minor surgery on his leg, and on a Tuesday, a day off, and I was just game planning and studying. I looked up and waiting for my son to come out of surgery. I looked up and Steve walks by me pushing a walker with his wife, Michelle. And I immediately called the trainer because I didn't know about it. And, oh, no, Steve's over there just getting an epidural injection because he can't walk right now. It's just so he can practice tomorrow.
Oh, my God. That's how tough he was. And you wouldn't have ever known if you hadn't been at the hospital and happened to see him go by on a walker.
Yeah, no, that was Steve. So anyway, Steve moves on and goes to Baltimore and lights it up.
And,
of all places.
Yeah, no, ironically enough, where Samari Roll went, also Derek Mason would end up there. I think, if I'm not mistaken, a lot of your former guys end up in Baltimore. And so you get Vince, and Vince comes in, and this is, immediately you get Vince to the playoffs, but at what point do you get nervous about the relationship or Vince? Because you're going from McNair, who you have, I think it's fair to say, one of the best relationships that a coach and a player could have at the quarterback position in that era, right? Like, you guys are twinned at the hip when people think about that era of NFL history. And then you get Vince, and it's a totally different dynamic. When do you start to get nervous?
Well, it was year two and three. The focus wasn't there. The commitment wasn't there. Or tried to help him through, days and days and weeks of time spent trying to encourage him and prepare him to deal with distractions. And it just, you know, as a coach, if you have the gifts and you recognize them, your most important responsibility, in my opinion, is to make sure that your players are emotionally, mentally, physically, spiritually prepared to come to work every day. And so with that, you should take on a lot of their stuff and to try to create an environment where they can focus and concentrate and get better and those kind of things. And that, just because of Vince's the distractions in his life, it was hard for Vince to do those kind of things.
And ultimately, that manifests itself in Vince, like, taking his pads off. He gets injured. And this is public, so it's like I'm asking you something that hasn't been out there before. He kind of throws a fit in the locker room, right, and then just storms out. Have you ever had an experience like that before?
Uh, No, I've not. Not after. No, it was an irrational moment. It was something that you know you don't just normally deal with. It was so far off the wall, and I tried to talk him prior to him walking across the locker room, but he didn't respond. And I said, if you walk out the door, you're never coming back. And I said, you guys need to help him, not and don't let him go out that door.
This is in the locker room with the whole team around, like he's just kind of losing it.
Yeah, and he walked out the door. And only one guy got up there and tried to stop me, kept walking.
And that was Michael Griffin tried to stop him, his former teammate from Texas, right?
You're pretty good, Clay. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it happens. You know, if you're in it long enough like I was, I mean, you're going to go through experiences. And I felt bad for Vince because, I'd liked Vince. He had a big heart and loved people and had so much potential. And I think in his case, the success, he experienced success way too soon. In college with the national championship and everything that he did there, because he was such an amazing athlete. And some of the games that he did for the wins, things he did in front of me were amazing. But at some point, that rabbit's foot gets, left in the car or left in your locker, and you gotta prepare. Not that he didn't prepare all the time, but it just wasn't like the rest of the guys, and there were just too many other things that were a distraction and important to him, and it just didn't work out, unfortunately. And I wished him the best. I never took anything personal, but I was there for him way beyond my normal call, my normal responsibility, and I couldn't get through to him.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We're talking to Jeff Fisher, Wins and Losses podcast. I'm Clay Travis. So later on, I believe this is true, Vince apologizes to you, right? Like tries to write you a letter. I think this is relatively recent.
Yes, I got a letter a few years ago. I didn't know it was from him. It should have been from him, but it was on University of Texas football stationery, and my name was spelled wrong. And so I did.
I mean, Fisher is not that complicated of a name to spell.
There was a C in it and stuff, but it was peculiar. I mean, there's phones, there's people want to make things right. There's other ways of doing it rather than a short letter. But yeah, he made an. I think now looking back, he made an attempt, but I don't know where he was coming from on that. And I hope for his sake that he kind of get things right, because he had a passion for kids, and he learned that from Steve.
Yeah,
because he called Steve Pops, and because that's what he got going in Steve McNair's camps. And I leaned on Steve numerous times to try to
get mentor to Vince. Yeah,
yeah. And as a matter of fact, Vince missed a plane on the way to Philadelphia, missed a team plane, and thought it was everybody's fault but his. Didn't want to play. Didn't want to play in the game. Didn't go. So we had to get Steve. I got Steve, and I called Steve Saturday night. He's getting ready to play, and asked where his plane was. He said Nashville. I said, well, can I borrow it? Will you send it and get Vince to Philly? We got a game tomorrow.
It's Saturday night, and he's not even in Philly yet.
No, he had just lost. We just lost the week before to Steve in Baltimore. We had a field goal blocked. And Vince almost beat Steve. And so the next week we're going to Philly, and he was late, he missed it. And people, that happens. If I'm late to a team plane, they're not going to wait on me.
Yeah.
Those things are slotted. It happens. I don't care. I mean, hey, I want to get him there. That's all. I wanted to get there, clean his mind out, and get him right, get him focused. It wasn't a punitive thing. But he just felt like we should have waited. And we did wait. But anyway, he didn't want to play. And then we beat Philly. Yeah, he put the opening drive together. He called four plays wrong, and each one averaged about 20 yards. the guys figured it out, and they make people miss tackles, and she threw a touchdown pass.
But he didn't get in until that Saturday night.
Oh, no, late. Yeah, real late. Didn't want to play in the morning either. I'd talk him into playing. So I told him that there wasn't a Longhorn on the tail of the airplane, the NFL.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay. It's all right. Let's go beat these guys. You know, that's all I cared about was them and their well-being and winning games. But anyway, it was quite an experience.
So
you're saying I need to write a book.
Yeah, I'm telling you need to write a book. But as part of this, okay, so Vince, like, storms out of the locker room. Nobody knows what's going on as the process plays out. I'm doing local radio. So this is where you and I first met, and okay. I think you hated me and may still hate me because this is I don't think I've told people this, but you would do in Nashville. We were the affiliate. I was doing local radio, 104.5 The Zone. I was on middays with Blaine Bishop. You came on several times as a part of that, and Vince is on the sideline and he just shows up, right? Like during a game. He wasn't there beforehand, and then he just shows up on the sideline. And that's kind of wacky to think about, right? Like, he just walks out down the tunnel. It's after he's injured. He's given his pads away, and he's just walking around on the sideline. And I went on the air, and I said, there's no way Jeff Fisher didn't know about this, right? Like, there's no way he wasn't. Because you said after the game, I had no idea he was there. And I went on, and I was like, I don't believe it. And so you're doing the local radio show, I think, that next week. And I'm not trying to put you on blast here, but I think you'll enjoy this now. And I think people who are listening will enjoy it because it kind of goes into sometimes the relationships between media and coaches, right? And just the environment in general. And you're off air and you said, I'd like to see Clay Travis in a dark alley sometime and kick his ass. And I loved it, right? Like, I was like, I think that is
you're doing good. Yeah, you're doing well.
But also
that kind of response out of me, you're doing your job.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah. But that's how controversial it was in Nashville. That VY Jeff Fisher, the Titans drama. It was all sorts of freighted with drama. And it's not, you know, that wasn't public. It was off air. But I hear that, and I'm like, man, that's phenomenal from Coach Fisher. But as you kind of evolved in Nashville. And I'm curious on this for people out there. Did you pay attention to media? Did you listen? How do you knock out the noise? Because in general, what people like I say don't really establish things very much, but it's also noise that's got to be frustrating as you're dealing with somebody like Vince. And only part of the story is out there, right?
First off, Clay, if I did say that, you pushed a button because it's not normally the way I respond, unless somebody is saying something that's not true.
Yeah.
Okay. Or back in the old days, you know, our responsibility when I started was to the local guys.
Yeah.
Was to you and to Kaharski and to Wyatt and to Legwald and all those guys, because you're there every single day and you're busting your butt and you're trying to get a story. And the worst thing I can do for our relationships is let a national guy beat you.
Right.
And so that's the philosophy there that to me was really important. Nowadays, I mean, it's completely flipped, and you know, I mean, everybody's, you're better to be first than right, and no one's accountable, and you know, that's a whole nother topic for another show. But but that was the thing. So something must have gone wrong. But the interesting part about what went down there was this game. I'm trying to think. Was it Washington?
I don't remember who the game was against.
But you bring in
Kerry Collins, right, as the backup.
No, Rusty.
Oh, Rusty Smith. Oh, yeah.
See, what happened in the game was we were just about in field position, scoring position, and Vince on first down threw a check down, and then I watched him, and we got 4 or 5 yards, and he's looking at his hand, and he keeps looking at his hand, and he goes back in the huddle, and the play call was a run, and he handed the ball off. And then now we're third and five or third and six, and we're in field goal range, and he takes a knee on the field. And so the clock's running down, so I call timeout. You know, I didn't want to take a delay, and so I burned a timeout, and he came off, and he says, my finger's messed up. And so I had the trainer there. I said, look at his finger. And the trainer goes, I think he tore his flexor tendon. And I go, oh, geez, that's not good. He can't throw. He goes, well, we're going to go in and check. So he goes in and checks. And the next drive, Rusty throws a touchdown pass to Randy Moss, who we had just signed a couple weeks prior.
Yeah.
But it's called back because of offensive pass interference. So anyway, after that drive, the trainer comes up to me with Vince and says, hey, Vince wants to try to go. I go, I'd love to have Vince go. Can he throw? And let me see if he can throw. So Vince takes a ball, and he throws it to Randy and on the sideline, and the ball lands in front of at his feet. So then he takes another ball, and he throws it to Randy, and it goes over. Now, Randy's 6'4".
Yeah.
It goes over Randy's head and hits the kicking net. And I just said, Vince can't control the football with his finger. He can't play. He's hurt. That's a normal reaction. And then that was at that point, that's when he took his pads off and got all upset. So I don't know what happened after that. I mean, I'm in the game. I didn't know he threw the pads in the stands or did this or did. I found out all that stuff after. But that's so then when I got in the locker room, he was ready to walk out. So he probably wouldn't have played the rest of that year anyway because of the condition of his finger. He couldn't control the football, but never saw him again.
Where were you when you found out about Steve McNair?
Clay, I was I had left on a trip, a really cool trip, with Bill Cowher, Tom Coughlin, John Gruden, and John Harbaugh. The five of us went to Iraq on a USO tour.
Wow.
And
because it was July 4th this date happened.
We had gone over there into June, and we were going to fly back on the 4th. So we had spent 6-7 days over there with General Odierno and our group, and just going from base to base to base.
And that had to be an amazing experience to see all those servicemen.
It was an amazing experience. There's things in that experience I was not able to share because of what happened when we were delayed because of the sandstorms in Baghdad, and our military aircraft that we took from Baghdad to Kuwait was delayed. And when we got to Kuwait, the tarmac, we were not going to make our flight from Kuwait back to LaGuardia. So it was kind of interesting because it's like, all right, we're not going to make it. We're going to stay someplace. I'll find, I can sleep any place. I'll find a place. Well, the other guys, well, I'm not going to mention who they were, but the other guys were like, well, I don't care. You know, coaches are like, get this guy here and get the plane here.
Yeah, right.
Wait. And,
yeah.
And so I had a satellite phone with me, and I pulled it out, and I was going to try to get service to talk to my kids and tell them it would be a little bit delayed. And then I grabbed my cell phone and just happened to turn it on, and I'm looking at it, and I didn't think I had service, and Eddie's number comes up, and I answer it. I go, 27, what are you doing, man? And he goes, Jeff, is it true? And that's how I found out. And I says, what true? He said, was Steve murdered? And I go, that's how I found out. I was on a tarmac, and Eddie was the first one. And then you can imagine that night in the hotel and trying to communicate and find out facts and all this, and it just was, wow, it was not an easy flight back. And then got off the plane and, you know, showered and then had to go to the press conference. So,
when you heard Eddie George say, coach, is it true? What does that feel like?
It was a shock. I mean, it was a devastating blow. And just your mind, you know. And I mean, you can imagine someone losing someone that you cared about. And I don't want to refer to Steve as my son, but I mean, we saw eye to eye. We were good friends. I love that man, his family, and everything that he did and accomplished and went through. And then to find out, I mean, I had seen him several weeks prior because he came out and played the softball game. You know, we had that
Jeff Fisher and Friends.
Yeah. And so he had come and was doing great. And Tyler and Trent were there and hanging out. Everything was good. I said, how's things going? He goes, I'm doing good, man. I got some shit I got to clean up, but I'm doing really good. And so then it happened.
And so there's no way you can get a playbook to prepare for anything like that. In fact, it hasn't happened for very many coaches in the history of the NFL. You're coming back from the Middle East. Is that entire several days just a blur?
Yeah, the flight, you know, the night was hard. I couldn't, because of the language barrier. I mean, I couldn't use the satellite phone because I couldn't step outside the hotel. It wasn't safe. So to try to make an international call to try to get information to contacts back here was really hard and really frustrating. I just couldn't get any information until I got to the airport the next morning. I started to get more information, then we're on a plane, no communication for that length of time. And then got off the plane, went home, changed, and then went to the press conference. So
it is still one of the most chilling stories and moments in recent NFL history. How much do you see the kids, or how much have you seen McNair's kids since?
You know, I haven't seen them, and, you know, we had them out to a farm, you know, a few years after Steve passed, and had them fishing, and, you know, kind of had some mutual friends that kind of stayed in touch, and stayed in touch with Michelle for a while, but I haven't, you know, over the last few years, people have moved on. Really happy to see Tyler doing well, and his dancing career and things like that, and, you know, I'm hearing that Michelle's doing okay. I mean, the 4th of July is different. It's different, you know, at least for me and for everybody that knew Steve. You know, you celebrate a lot of different things, and then reality hits you, and especially I think this year was 10 years.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And so it was hard. And, you know, those of us that were close, and I'll include you in that because of your passion for research and journalism and everything, there's a lot of still unanswered questions.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the family just wants it to rest. They want Steve to rest. They don't want any more investigations. They don't want any more of that. So, I mean, people are honoring their wishes, I'm sure.
Did you follow up on that? Because you have a lot of, and for people out there who are listening to us right now and don't understand the concept of the city of Nashville, Nashville is a big city in some ways. It's also a small town in others. And what I mean by that is maybe in New York or L.A. you can disappear because the communities are just so big. In Nashville, everybody knows everybody else, and everybody will know about your business, or there's not very much degrees that separate you. So when you're the head coach of the Tennessee Titans, you're pretty plugged in with the local police department because you want to know whether your guys are getting in trouble or not, right? I mean, that's just and I'm sure that's true in different other cities as well. But in Nashville, I think it's particularly true because the city's just not so big.
And so it's small, and and had to, over time, you have to lean on those resources to find out, to get facts, to what happened, who was there, what went down. I mean, these are young guys. There's temptations. There's going to be issues. I mean, I always say this. We'll circle back, but you know, when somebody, wherever you're coaching, and somebody, you get the guys that really know what's going on. They say, hey, look, these three places, tell your guys to stay away.
Yeah.
They're not good. There are going to be problems. The place is going to come down. There's going to be a raid. You know, they're whatever. And when you stand up and tell the guys that, they look at you, and where are the first three places they go? To those places. But that's the, you know, so yeah, you are. You are in the know, in the loop. And, you know, you're going to have a lot of conversations with people, confidential conversations. So yeah, I had a lot of information.
So they did that whole podcast and everything else examining the death. Do you believe, like, based on the people that you talked to, that it was a murder suicide? Like that the story that is out there is 100% true?
I think there's reason to believe otherwise, and it just lacks facts and information. And I think that somewhere, somebody closed it, and I don't know why. But I'm not saying it was Nashville law enforcement. I'm not saying somehow that the line was not connected somehow, some way. And again, it may be. I mean, it, you know, we're not there. You know, God only knows. But we lost a good man.
There's a lot of people,
and another life. So
yeah, there's a lot of people in Nashville who have that belief that there might have been something other than the murder-suicide, and it's certainly been examined. And and that potentially somebody who killed Steve McNair could still be at large. I mean, that is, for people out there who don't know this, that is there is that possibility that some people believe.
Yes, I have heard that. Do I share that opinion? I just need more information, and I have come to terms with it. I was honored to be able to stand up and eulogize Steve. Once in Nashville, and then once down in Hattiesburg, and I have some closure. But you know, my heart still hurts for Michelle and the boys, and those others that were very close to him.
And Steve, and I'll just speak to this because I was out and about in Nashville more so when I was younger before I had the three boys. Steve would be out and about a lot, but a lot of times he had people with him, right, that were there kind of to protect him in some way. And so it always seems strange to me that he would put himself into a position where something like that could happen. Does that make sense to you, too? Like, Steve was a beloved guy in this city. It didn't seem like he had a lot of enemies.
Yeah, in addition to that, you know, it was what he had planned. I mean, he had to go take care of some business. That's why he left the house. And then never came back. But his plans were to take the boys fishing the next day.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
We're talking to Jeff Fisher. This is the Wins and Losses podcast. I'm Clay Travis. You leave the Titans after 15 years. What was that experience like to have your tenure come to a close? You talked about Steve McNair on a knee at the Super Bowl. You're so achingly close to having the best team in the NFL multiple years. Home field advantage another year with Kerry Collins when they step in and you have a great 13-3 season. The Ravens come in again. Joe Flacco's a rookie. They put together another one of those freaky, flukish type games and find a way to win. What is your feeling as you're driving away from Baptist Sports Park in Nashville after 15 years?
Well, when I made the decision, and it was a collective decision. I sat down with management and Mr. Adams and felt like it was the best thing for everybody. And so then it took me probably 3 days to clean my office out, but nonetheless, it wasn't easy. It was a long run. It was a great run. I was tired. Mr. Adams was, with age, he was becoming, I think, more of a challenge to deal with. And it just was that, you know, to be honest with you, Clay, I made myself a commitment when I got into coaching. It was, if I didn't look forward to going to work, you know, one morning, if I wake up not look forward to going to work, I wasn't going to go in. And it was a combination of things. I think it was Vince. It was just a combination of things where I was in my personal life. And I just needed a break. It was a long run, you know. It was a long, long run. So I took the break, and it was, it hurt. It hurt because it was, you know, that was my life. Nashville was my life. The Titans were our team. And I gave my heart and soul to that organization and don't have any regrets whatsoever. The only regret I guess I have is that I didn't get Mr. Adams a trophy that I signed on. I told him I'd get him when he hired me. But, beyond that, it was time. And it was, I took advantage of that time. I needed that time, and I took the year. I, over the years, have reached out to some other coaches that have, for whatever reason, gotten out, just to encourage them to take the time and get recharged and how to plan the day and how to plan the month. And because oftentimes when you are going so hard for so long and then there's nothing, you find yourself stressing at the end of the day, and that's because you yourself put together your to-do list, and you can't stress over your own to-do list type of thing, you know. So anyway, the whole experience, the 11 experience, was good for me. My son was playing at Auburn. I got to attend all the home and away games. I put my hat on backwards and went through the SEC, and it was just really good. And I fully intended on coming back, and I was very, very fortunate to have an opportunity to choose when I did come back that next year.
What was it like to get to go watch your son play at Auburn?
It was an amazing experience. I mean, my oldest played at University of Montana, and I catch a few games here in a national championship or a playoff game, and then to go down and watch him play was really, really nothing like it. You know, I mean, it was just, and I was a dad too. You know, I was a dad there. I mean, it was a cool place. College football is really a great experience. I've actually, to be honest with you, kind of gotten a little closer to college football the last couple of years. Just interest and intrigue in the programs and who's doing what and how things go and how things work. Cause, you know, I guess I'm moving a different direction in the conversation, but I miss the players and I miss the sideline. And I miss the relationships, and the players were important to me, and you've enabled me to illustrate that to my relationship with Steve and so many others that I crossed paths with over the years, and even my short time at the Rams, but I was really excited for their success because I had a hand in that, and I've maintained relationships with them and I hear from them all the time. And it's just that's what you miss. And, this day and age, when players walk in the door, it's different. They don't know you. They don't respect you. They don't trust you. And the sooner you can, cross those bridges and establish relationships with them, the better off you are. And so many of them want an adult male relationship in their life, and they don't have it. And I found myself being that person for so many of the players over the years.
You're almost a surrogate father. And then when I want to go to the Rams thing, you end up making the move back to Los Angeles. You draft Jared Goff. You draft Todd Gurley. Do you watch every Rams game the past couple of years?
Well, I'd say the first year, no. I watched the last four after I was or three after I was let go because I was helping the interim head coach with all his daily duties. And then things changed, staff changed. I was really happy for Sean. And they made the moves that they needed to make and that we've been talking about making. And it's a hard thing. And it's not an excuse, but the relocation thing is not easy. And when you change addresses, well, one, two, three, four times in 6 months. And train camp and all those things, there's distractions. And then on top of that, you take a team from a really cool market in St. Louis into a giant market like L.A. is. You almost have to take the approach, hey, we're not moving to L.A., we're playing in L.A. And you guys have to live here, and here are the traffic patterns, and here's this, and here's that, all those things, and facilities, and designing stadiums, and all that stuff. There were just a lot of other things that you had to do. But I was not surprised whatsoever at their success, because I knew Jared was gonna be that guy. And same thing with Todd and Aaron and those guys that I had a hand in drafting.
You had five Rookie of the Years: Javon Kearse, Chris Johnson, Vince Young, Aaron Donald, Todd Gurley, and Jared Goff seems like he's going to pan out as a really good quarterback. You are 13th, I think, all-time on the NFL win list, and you're 15 wins away from being in the top 10 winningest of all time. Some people listening to that right now are probably surprised by it. You're only 61 years old. I say only because there's a lot of coaches who coach for a long time now, right? Do you want to coach college or the NFL again? Do you feel like your career's over?
Well, I don't feel like it's over because I want to do it again, yeah. I've had a couple years to reflect, to take care of myself, to learn. I feel great physically, and I've been able to do things that I haven't been able to do for however long I've been in this great game, coaching and playing. and I miss it. And I know I have a lot to offer. So yeah, I have interest in, but that's not my call. I'm not out kicking doors down or doing those kind of things. But it's interesting to watch the league and see where it's gone. And it's leaning to the younger guys, which is good. I mean, in my opinion, there's only one Sean McVay. And, you know, the other guy, we'll see how the other guys pan out. And I wish them nothing but the best. But there are a lot of things that they haven't experienced before. And, it's interesting in that, it's hard to convince someone to leave themselves 4 hours a day for things that are going to come up.
That you don't control at all.
That you have no control over. And how do you go about dealing with those circumstances? And how do you avoid them? And how do you create an environment where, and this is really, I remain close with Chris Long. I mean, how about that career?
Yeah.
And Chris says all the time, he goes, man, I had so much fun. And we were bad. Yeah, we were bad. When I took that team over, they were 2-14. Nobody lost more games in 5 year span in the history of the NFL than the Rams. We had some work to do, but what I want to do from day one is I wanted these guys to learn how to pull in the parking lot and run in the building looking forward to coming to work, because knowing full ahead of time that there's going to be some days when they don't want to come, some of those Mondays. And you got to take the same approach when you come in. And so it was just about that, the chemistry and just the other people in the organization, the lives that you touch and you affect go way beyond the individual player lives if you're running an organization appropriately. And, I've had some individual experiences with players that blow away any great win I ever had. Just to see them turn their lives around or get things right in their lives and enjoy happiness and success. And whether it's dealing with an addiction or dealing with the depression or whatever it is, but just those type of things are, they're much more rewarding than wins. Now, don't misunderstand me here. Winning is everything. You do it to win. But there's you have to take care of those things in order to win. And so those are the things that I miss.
Would you want to coach college?
I would coach. It was the right program and the right people, and I would coach at the college level. And that doesn't mean to say it has to be a Power Five. I love coaching. I'm a ball coach. I love coaching. I love helping and mentoring and seeing people have success and having fun and people smiling when they work and when they practice and growing. I mean, I think what better opportunity than college to help the young student athletes become men. That's cool stuff. And there's so many outstanding college coaches out there. And I think over the last couple of years, everything is about winning, and social media has kind of kicked things off maybe on the wrong track sometime for people, and people then tend to lose the right perspective on what they're doing and why they're doing it.
You've kind of hopped into the social media space a little bit. You can give people your Twitter handle and had fun with the idea that you are 7-9, 8-8, 9-7, because that's kind of the reputation that you have in that universe. And by the way, it's a lot of NFL teams out there right now that would love to be 8-8 or 7-9 or 9-7. It's hard to win on a regular basis in the NFL.
Yeah.
What have you found with social media?
I'll circle back there, but it's funny. I also lost a lot of games.
Yeah.
And that's what people grab onto. But if you're a head coach for 20 years and you go 10-6, you're going to lose 120 games.
Yeah.
And that's right up there with the most losingest coach in the history of the NFL.
Yeah.
I've been around a while. But to your point, in my year off in 2011, I climbed Kilimanjaro with the Wounded Warrior Project because I will do anything in a heartbeat for the military. And so climbed Kilimanjaro for the Wounded Warrior Project. And so I opened Twitter. And I thought, this would be really, someone said, you need to open Twitter and kind of share this experience. And I said, okay, cool. So I did. Then I got over to Amsterdam before I flew to Tanzania, and I didn't get any service. And I couldn't figure out how to use it, and I hadn't used a cent. So it was just laid there up until about 4 months ago or whatever. And I just kind of was reflecting and having some conversation. And, you know, I'm getting my, I made this reference, I get my rear end drugged down the asphalt in social media for 2 years since I got let go. I'm gonna tell the truth, you know, and have fun with it. And that's what, it's been really fun. And I appreciate the followers, and it's been fun. And, you know, yeah, I do have a sense of humor. Yeah, I built, we're flipping houses in Nashville with my daughter and son-in-law. And yeah, there's the rooms are bigger than 7 and 9. Actually, 13 by 3. And people loved it. So, yeah, it's good. It, you know, it's really fun. So I'm not just sitting up in the backwoods here.
You are right now, though, in Montana by yourself, right? Is that correct? Up in the
cabin? I got my dog here. Yeah.
So you will be up. So, like, what will you do tomorrow? You'll hang up. We finish this interview. You will spend the rest of the day doing what? And then, what will you do when you wake up? Like, how do you spend your time while you're up there?
I love exercising. I love fishing, and I'm doing some other things, doing some charity things and raising some money, you know, for some people, helping some things, people. And I'm gonna, you know, the next couple of weeks, I'm gonna kind of gear up for the college season. My oldest is coaching at Southern Utah, Brandon. He's a defensive coordinator, and they open against UNLV, so I'm gonna be there. And root him on, and so I'll do some games. But I'm going to come back to Nashville, and I love the high school football environment in Nashville. My youngest son is joined the CPA staff as a teacher and as a coach there in Nashville. So I'm going to, you know, I'm going to be a dad, and I'm a grandpa, and, you know, I'm going to work out, and even though I'm 61, I'm going to keep feeling like I'm 45.
So, question for you, last couple of questions here, and I appreciate all the time. I'm Clay Travis, Wins and Losses with Jeff Fisher. What kind of experience did you have outside of coaching the Titans, raising your kids in Nashville? When you would go to get a chance to go to a high school football game and watch your boys, did people give you your space? Did you feel like you had a good family experience away from your job?
Yeah, it's a great question. Keep this in mind. My kids are 5 years apart, and all three of them attended the same elementary and graduated from the same high school.
Which is unheard of for a coach.
Doesn't happen in coaching. And so with that being said, yeah, everybody wants to say hi, but you know what? It's like everybody's your friend. It's just, you know, I'm just one of them, you know? It's kind of like they're used to seeing you. And then, yeah, I was able to be a dad. You know, it was a great experience. And, you know, I have two that made Nashville their home and one that loves Nashville that can't be there. But, yeah, it's a great place to live and great fans and, you know, great memories. I mean, great memories. You know, I still have a little farm outside of Nashville and great people out there and, you know, a lot of good friends there in town still.
So last question for you. When you go to bed, you know, if you have dreams about coaching or you have dreams about games or you have dreams about playing, is there any one that comes up the most? You've had so many over the years. Is there any game you think about if you're standing there fishing, casting out into the lake? You might be out by yourself. You're out walking. People naturally think back about what they've done in their career, in their life. Is there any game that comes up the most in your mind?
Not a particular game, but the game itself. I want people, listeners, to understand that the game at the high school level is where it's pure, and it's just its finest. And the further you get from high school, the more complicated it becomes. But nonetheless, it's still a great game. But so no games. But I do. This is out there. But this game is played in the fall, and there, to me, that's my favorite time of the year. And I can see fall in any day, any place. And you know how you go outside sometimes in the Harris Chris, you go, oh man, it feels like fall. Well, you know what? Every day since I got out of coaching feels like fall to me, and I love the fall. So I missed a lot of days in the fall because I was coaching, but those days at Lambeau or those days in New England or those days at Pittsburgh or Cincinnati or Cleveland, Seattle, you know, it's just all over the country, and coaching those games in October, September, October, November, they're memories that I'll never forget. And I wish that, you know, people could experience those because it is it's an amazing game. And, you know, yeah, there's a lot going on. It's like politics or anything else. But when you get right down to it, I mean, it's like, you know, Kenny Chesney saw in the Boys of Fall.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's ball, you know, and I'm really grateful because I was able to, you know, to make an outstanding living and have the friendships and the experiences that I had, that I've had, and they all spun off of this game. And I wouldn't be having this conversation with you, Clay, if it weren't for the game. So do I miss it? Oh, yeah. Am I ready to come back? You betcha.
Outstanding stuff, Jeff Fisher. Get out and enjoy Montana. I appreciate the time. This has been absolutely fantastic. I'm Clay Travis. You've been listening to the Wins and Losses podcast. If you enjoy it, go rate us. If you enjoy this conversation, you'll probably enjoy a lot of others too. Share it with your friends. Thanks to Coach Fisher. This has been fantastic, and this has been Wins and Losses. Coach.